This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Sounds Choral, a program that seeks to present the vast body of choral repertoire in a way that is intelligible, relevant, entertaining, and uplifting. I'm your host, Ryan Brando, the Artistic Director of Amor Artis, Princeton Pro Musica, and the Monmouth Civic Chorus. We just heard a work by Haydn called Insane et Vane Cure, as performed by John Eliot Gardner and his Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque Soloists. In 1775, Haydn completed his first oratorio, Il Ritorno di Tobia, The Return of Tobias. It was his only contribution in the Italian oratorio style, and it isn't much known today, but a part of it lived on. One of the choruses, known as the Storm Chorus, was transformed into a sacred motet on the text, Insane et Vane Cure. Insane and stupid worries flood our minds. Often mad fury fills the heart, robbed of hope. O mortal man, what good does it to strive for worldly things if you neglect the heavens? All things work in your favor with God on your side. That oratorio movement that became the motet is almost a study for the work we're going to listen to today, Haydn's Missa in Angustiis, Mass in a Time of Distress, commonly known as the Lord Nelson Mass. Haydn wrote the original oratorio version at the same time that he was writing symphonies with fiery figuration that some commentators, long after they were written, likened to the Sturm und Drang literary movement. The sweeter, calmer sections of that motet sound all the more relieved against its agitated beginning. As performers and listeners of music, we can never predict how real-world events will shape the music we perform and the music we hear. As much as music helps us transcend our here and now, there are certain times when it's impossible to perform in a vacuum and ignore the way that the music we hear can resonate with our life, echoing and amplifying its joys and struggles. This was certainly the case with Haydn at the end of the 18th century. His six great late masses were written during the final lap of his career, when he'd achieved fame across Europe, plenty of money, and a great deal of success. But the world around him was roiled by the Napoleonic Wars. The Mass we're going to hear today, which Haydn titled in his catalog Mass in a Time of Distress, was written in the midst of the Battle of the Nile. That battle was the climax of a naval campaign that had ranged across the Mediterranean during the previous 3 months as a large French convoy sailed from Toulon to Alexandria carrying a force under Napoleon Bonaparte. The British fleet were led in that battle by the Rear Admiral Sir Horatio Nelson. They decisively defeated the French. The battle reversed the strategic situation between the two nations and entrenched the Royal Navy in the dominant position that they held for the rest of the war. The news of Lord Nelson's victory over the French electrified Allied Europe. And from its first performance, possibly, the piece came to be known by its present title, the Lord Nelson Mass. Certainly by the time of Nelson's 1805 triumph at the Battle of Trafalgar, which resulted in his death, the Mass had gained that title. There's a fun little anecdote. Supposedly, one of Haydn's biographers, Carl Geringer, notes that a chart of the Battle of the Nile was found among Haydn's papers. Legend has it that upon meeting Haydn in 1800, Admiral Nelson is said to have asked for the pen with which the composer wrote the Mass in exchange for a gold watch. We don't know whether that's true or not, but we do know that Haydn composed the Mass in just 53 days in the summer of 1798. It premiered that September. Haydn seems to have caught the bug for choral music during his trips to England, during which he composed his famous London symphonies. Those symphonies, some of Haydn's most beloved, expanded the scope of that genre, with slow introductions, longer movements, and deft control of large-scale forms. Haydn left London with those skills more honed than ever, but he also left London eager to start writing more choral music. A few months after Haydn first came to England in 1784, he attended one of the massive Handel commemorations at Westminster Abbey. After hearing the impact of this colossal chorus assembled for the event, singing Handel's grand anthems, Haydn purportedly said, "He is the master of us all." So when he returned to Esterhazy, he set out to work on the first of his two great oratorios, Creation. Creation has a ton of colorful orchestral effects, beautiful solos, and grand choruses. Haydn's situation at the Esterhazy Palace, where he had worked for many, many years, also changed at that time. The new prince, Nicholas II, reinstated the the big music program. And as part of that, Haydn was asked to write a mass on a very grand scale each year for the name day celebration of the princess. The first of these, 1796's Missa in Tempore Belli, Mass in a Time of War, like the Lord Nelson Mass, acknowledged the reality of the Napoleonic Wars happening around them. 2 years later, the wars more intense than ever, Haydn penned his only mass in a minor key, the Nelson Mass. The work displays an intensity reminiscent of the Sturm und Drang works, partnered with the technical brilliance and the formal security of the London symphonies. Now, because of the political and financial instability of this time, Haydn's patron, though he reinstated the music program that summer of 1798, dismissed the winds from the palace. So shortly before Haydn set to work to write this year's name day mass, he knew he was going to have to do it without any wind players. I think Haydn took that limitation and made it into inspiration and tried to extract the maximum effect from the forces that he had. The Missa in Angustiis stands apart to my ear from the other late masses in the way that it uses instrumentation and texture to pit this powerful sense of urgency and anxiety against really jubilant, effervescent, joyous passages. In his original scoring, which we're going to hear today, it's just a string orchestra with an organ, three trumpets, and timpani. There's a really stark contrast in the timbre of those two instrumental groups, and it sharpens, I think, the martial blare quality of the brass and the beating of the drums. The pointed trumpet fanfares and pleading sighs of the chorus in the opening Kyrie, and the almost menacing advance of the trumpets and timpani in the Benedictus are as severe as any music written to that point. At the same time, from the strings, Haydn coaxes sweet lyricism and fiery, surging passage work. The first few measures of the orchestral introduction in the Kyrie could easily function as a film score in a battle scene, but just a few bars in, we hear the other side of the coin with a lovely melody from the violins. The famously acrobatic, impassioned soprano solo in the Kyrie gives an individual's voice to the prevailing sense of anxiety. She cries high above the storm of the strings and the trumpets. The four sections of the chorus enter one on top of another, piling up dissonances through insistent repetitions of the plea, "Have mercy on us." The sense of desperation grows through the descending chromatic sighs. The return of the original Kyrie music is made, I think, more heartrending by the soprano soloist's florid cries above. Following the true spirit of the text, in this case painfully relevant in time of war, Haydn infuses the music with a prayerful urgency. The sound of entreaty, both individual and congregational, pervade the Mass and especially the opening Kyrie. We're going to listen today to a recording of this Mass by John Eliot Gardiner, the English Baroque soloists, and the Monteverdi Choir. Here's the Kyrie.
Thank you.
This is Sounds Choral. I'm your host, Ryan Brando, and today we're listening to Haydn's Lord Nelson Mass. The Mass is famous, of course, for the coloratura fireworks in the Kyrie, but they come back in the Gloria, where the stormy D minor gives way to an especially ebullient D major. A lot of concert-length Mass settings make a clear distinction between aria movements and choral sections, in the manner of opera. But throughout the Nelson Mass, the solos and the ensemble passages remain closely integrated. There's a dialogue, and this is especially true in the first part of the Gloria. The Qui Tolli section of the Gloria starts surprisingly in B-flat major. A bass solo is accompanied by some really lovely scoring for the strings and organ. The choir enters on a rather haunting unison chant, Miserere nobis, have mercy on us, in dialogue with the bass. Then the soprano enters, trading her coloratura for long, arcing sighs on the word suscipe, receive. She only sings the first word of that sentence, and the choir finishes it with deprecationem nostrum, our prayer. So soprano and choir work together to say, receive our prayer. These poignant exchanges are embedded in a beautiful orchestral texture that's motivated by some nudging eighth notes and some lovely filigree in the violins and organ. The end of the long Gloria, the soprano returns, brings us back to D major for Quoniam tu solus sanctus, reviving the opening material from the Gloria in Excelsis. And the whole thing ends with a really jaunty choral fugue on In Gloria Dei Patris. Amen. Let's hear this Gloria. Again, we're listening today to John Elliott Gardiner, the Monteverdi Choir, and the English Baroque soloists. This is the Gloria of Haydn's Lord Nelson Mass. the Credo, which is the other long text of a Mass setting, Haydn fashions something just as varied and interesting. In the first of the movements of the Credo, the Mass's group statement of belief, all the voices sing the same music. The sopranos and tenors sing exactly the same thing throughout, an octave apart. The altos and basses follow just a measure behind and a fifth below. It's a canon. So the single line of music, refracted through the laws of counterpoint and harmony, creates this sparkling, bustling whole. Out of one strong idea, Haydn makes an entire musical fabric. The Et Incarnatus Est takes the form of a beautiful exchange between the soprano soloists and chorus, again, surrounded by some of Haydn's most beautiful writing for strings. The martial trumpets of the Kyrie reappear, forebodingly, at the mention of suffering under Pontius Pilate. Then, in the midst of a fiery Et Resurrexit, Haydn does the opposite of what he did at the beginning of the Credo, uniting the voice parts into one unison line. Here's Haydn's Lord Nelson Mass, the Credo movement, as performed by John Elliott Gardiner, the English Baroque soloists, and the Monteverdi Choir.
Thank you.
on now to the Sanctus and Benedictus movements. After a radiant Sanctus, Haydn crafts a Benedictus that befits his designation of a Mass in a time of distress. In classical period Mass settings, the Benedictus can often be a peaceful moment of repose, maybe decorated by a violin solo or an organ solo. But Haydn's Benedictus in this Mass takes a decidedly different form, reminding us always of the unease not far from our own shores. The opening orchestral prelude in D minor sets up a gorgeous restrained soprano solo, but soon the trumpets and drums reappear, beginning a slow, inexorable advance. About 5 minutes into the movement, the trumpets and drums have now arrived face to face and deliver menacing triplet fanfares on a unison low D as the sopranos climb up to top B-flat. It is truly rattling. Let's hear these two movements back to back, the Sanctus and Benedictus. This is Sounds Choral. I'm your host, Ryan Brando, and today we're listening to Haydn's Lord Nelson Mass. The final movement, the Agnus Dei, opens with a long passage for the four soloists in G major. It gives the choir a little break. Then, at the Dona Nobis Pacem, the music returns triumphantly to D major. The fugue subject for the Dona Nobis Pacem begins with a rest, so that the Dona sounds syncopated. The ending of this great mass is as exuberant as its famous opening is angsty. In the summer of 1798, as now, political divisions and warfare brought distress around the globe. Then, news traveled slowly. Now, news saturates our screens instantaneously. We're constantly made to confront humanity's worst and hope for humanity's best. Haydn's Lord Nelson Mass moves from a place of great distress to a place of joyous peace. If you tuned in today to escape the noise, I hope you were uplifted by the unfettered joy of Haydn's setting of Dona Nobis Pacem. If you tuned in today with a mind as stormy and dissonant as the Kyrie, I hope listening to Haydn's Mass helped you find a way forward. We've heard today from John Elliott Gardiner, the English Baroque soloists, the Monteverdi Choir, and soloists Sally Bruce Payne, Peter Butterfield, Gerald Finley, and Donna Brown. So we'll end today by hearing the final movement of Haydn's Lord Nelson Mass, the Agnus Dei, which wraps up with a Dona Nobis Pacem fugue. Thank you for listening. Sounds Choral is produced at the studios of WWFM, the classical network, David Osenberg, producer. I'm your host, Ryan Brando, the director of Amor Artis, Princeton Pro Musica, and the Mammoth Civic Chorus. I'll be back next week alongside Sounds Choral host Gabriel Crouch, and together we're going to look at another piece written in response to war, Benjamin Britten's one-of-a-kind War Requiem. Gabriel and I have been preparing the choirs that we conduct for a joint performance with the Princeton University Orchestra, which will take place at the end of the month, April 27th and 28th, at Richardson Auditorium. You can listen to any recent Sounds Choral program by going to our website, wwfm.org, and clicking on Classical and Webcasts. You can also support programming like this with a donation and membership at our website. Thank you so much for listening. Sounds Choral is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and wwfm.org.